And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Gonna put one foot in front of the other foot.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on. Got to keep on going.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
When my grandmama marched.
Hi there. I'm Jeff Browning, and welcome to Benders of the Arc podcast, where we interview movers and shakers for social change.
Welcome to this episode of the Benders of the Arc podcast. Today we will be talking about guns, gun violence, and most importantly, gun violence prevention. We are recording this episode on March 8th of 2023. And already, less than 3 months into the year, there have already been more than 100 mass shootings in our country. Statistics on gun violence seem to only go in one direction, up. For context, here are a few statistics to help us all understand the magnitude of this problem. Children in the U.S. are 12 times more likely to die from firearms than children in the next 25 industrialized nations combined. In 2021, gun violence killed 48,830 people in the U.S. That's almost an 8% increase over 2020 record. Among those killed by gun violence in 2021 were 2,571 children. Firearm suicide deaths increased by 8.4%, and firearm homicide deaths increased by 8.1%. These statistics are shocking and disheartening. And what is even more infuriating is that most citizens across the political spectrum want to see sensible gun laws in place, but our politicians don't have the courage to legislate them into law. So, in light of this often disheartening news, I have two guests with me today to help us understand the spiritual and practical steps that they are using to help empower communities and people to begin making our community safer for everyone. My guests are the Reverend Deanna Hollis and the Reverend Eric Swanson. The Reverend Deanna Hollis is the Gun Violence Prevention Ministry Coordinator with the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship and a founding member of the Every Town for Gun Safety Interfaith Advisory Council. In her role with the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship, Reverend Hollis empowers and equips individuals and congregations across the Presbyterian Church USA denomination to embody Jesus' call to love God and love neighbor by being informed and active in the prevention of gun violence. She holds a Master of Divinity degree from Perkins School of Theology, as well as a diploma in the Art of Spiritual Direction from San Francisco Theological Seminary. The Reverend Eric Swanson has been pastor at West Hope Presbyterian Church in Saratoga for the last 17 years, transforming it into an active contemplative community. The mass shooting in Las Vegas spurred Eric to begin working on firearm safety at the local and state levels. He's worked together with religious leaders from different faith communities to work to end this national tragedy. So welcome, Deanna and Eric. Thank you for being with me.
I gave a brief introduction to the work that each of you are doing.
Please take a couple of minutes to tell us a bit more about yourself and about your work and how you came to do this work. Deanna, would you like to start us off?
I'd be happy to. So I first, I live in Dallas, Texas, and so I first became active in gun violence prevention when Texas passed a law in 2016 that allowed guns on college campuses. My oldest daughter was a student at Texas Tech at the time, and I was able to witness how her friends reacted to that. And they reacted exactly as the law intended, and that they saw it as an invitation to buy guns. That, you know, if the law says that you are supposed to have guns, then you by all means need a gun. So not knowing what to do, not feeling like I could keep my daughter safe, it had been a really hard time raising her. I was going to be really upset if this was how she was to die after all that work. I had a friend who had just joined Moms Demand Action. So I joined Moms Demand Action and started, you know, learning all I could, and looked after the NRA came to town, to Dallas in 2018. I really felt a call to combine, you know, my Christian life and ministry with gun violence prevention. Saw that, you know, that I might be able to be helpful to the local pastor who has multiple things to concern themselves with it by doing a deep dive into this one particular area that I had already started. So that was what led to my ordination in 2019 to the role of gun violence prevention ministry coordinator with the Presbyterian Peace Fellowship.
Great. Thank you. Eric, tell us a little bit more about your work and ministry.
Yeah, so as you said in the introduction, once the Las Vegas mass shooting happened, I really got furious. I said, we as a country have to be better than this. This is insane. How can a civilized, what we proclaim to be a civilized nation, allow so many people to die? And again, as you said, the more I looked into it, the numbers all pointed in one direction. And as crazy, it's getting worse and worse and worse, rather than, oh my gosh, we have a problem, what can we do about it? So I called up our mayor in our city here and said, listen, how can we start working on this? He said, well, we really can't as a city. I said, point me to somebody who can. So he connected me to our local state congressman, our assemblyman, Evan Lowe, who received me really well. So we sat down and talked, and we made an agreement. He said, if you get some more pastors together, I'll get some more assemblymen together. I said, deal. Sounds good. And so he got another assemblyman. He got one. I got 95. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little disproportionate, but it worked. And so and my son helped me organize. He's in politics. He helped me organize the Community Interfaith Voice, a group with rabbis and imams and clergy from many different denominations, to work to take a stand for gun violence prevention. And we got Safe Storage passed here in Saratoga. NRA came out. We didn't even know that they're NRA people in Saratoga, but gall darn it if they didn't show up for it. And we've been working with local political leaders ever since.
That's great. Well, I want to dive a little bit more into your the work that each of you are doing. But before we do that, how about a little explanation or context, theological and otherwise? I know that James Atwood has written a couple of books on this, and I think his last book was Fundamentalism. What's the name of it? Where is it taking America? Deanna, can you tell us anything about what Jim meant by fundamentalism?
Well, that, you know, we've just become obsessed with guns, that it really is a religion for people, that it really is idolatry, you know, that this is the gun is where people put their faith and their hope. That, and there are signs that you'll see. When I was at the March for Our Lives, kids came to town on their summer bus tour, and there were protesters across the street from them, and they had a sign that said, you know, gun safe, right? I mean, they, instead of Jesus save, gun save. So it literally is where they put their faith and their hope. And that's what I think, you know, this fundamentalism is that it's this real unmoving worship and trust in what guns will do for us and what violence will do for us. And to be fair, through the research that I've done, is that folks didn't get there without some intentional effort on the part of those who profit from guns. Because one of the things that that a lot of us don't realize, I think, is that a gun is a non-consumable product. And so if you have a business, there's two things you have to do. Is you have to sell whatever it is. And so you need customers and you need demand for your product. And so that's one of the problems that gun manufacturers have always had ever since the factory model, is who's going to buy their product and what happens when the market becomes saturated and there's no demand for their product. And so they have to come up with new ways to get either the same customers to buy more guns, or they have to get new customers into the market. And guess what buys gun or sells guns, gets new customers into the market every time? Gun violence. Every time we have a mass shooting or you know, gun violence increases, people become afraid. And so they think they need a gun, because the gun industry has been very successful with their marketing by telling us that we will be safer with guns, that guns save, right? Guns save lives. And so this myth that the gun industry has spent just billions of dollars on over, you know, decades, has infiltrated our consciousness. We've lost our imagination for what the world could be like without guns. And again, this was intentional. They knew as far back as the early 1900s that if they could equate the gun with identity formation, what it means to become a man, this whole idea of the Wild West and John Wayne, you know, all those early Westerns were paid for by gun manufacturers in order to get them developed so that we could begin to have these, you know, thoughts about guns and what it does for us, this hero mentality into our consciousness. So, and they've also been very intentional with the use of God language around it to make sure that it becomes, you know, the sacrament that it is. And there's a fascinating study that was done by Jessica Dawson. She's the Department of Behavioral Sciences and Leadership at West Point. And what she did was she tracked the usage of God language over time in the American Rifleman, which is the magazine of the NRA. And there's a couple that are really fascinating to see. And one is, you know, this idea of God given, which is what you hear now from gun rights enthusiasts, that they vehemently say that this is a God-given right. Well, again, Jessica Dawson was able to track when that phrase entered into our lexicon and how it was initially used, which was in reference to, you know, like a skill, like an ability, like, oh, this person is a really good shooter. They have this God-given talent, was how it was initially used. But then the term began to shift in the 1990s, which is when it began to, the first time it was tied to a government-granted privilege was in 1994. And by doing that and repeating this usage of God-given, they were able then, and when I say they, I'm talking about, you know, the gun lobby was able to then shift the way we interpreted the Constitution in 2008, so that the Second Amendment for the first time was interpreted as an individual right, where before it had always been a collective right. And when that happens, you begin to see gun manufacturing just begins to increase, which will then translate into gun sales. But when it really takes off, gun manufacturing, the highest level on record is after Sandy Hook. So if you're in the gun business, what you learned is that killing kindergartners is good for business. And if lawmakers are beholden to gun industry profits and to these, that's what happens. That's why nothing happens is, you know, we're finally seeing a shift for the first time in that you have lawmakers that are actively running on gun violence prevention platforms. You're seeing the shift in legislation. But every time we've made progress on restricting guns in any way, the gun industry fights back. And they do this because they know they have a non-consumable product in a saturated market.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Eric, is there anything that you would like to add?
From a theological standpoint, particularly as a pastor in a congregation, I mean, it is fascinating for me to hear and put together theological concepts that all point against gun violence. I mean, Jesus himself was known as the Prince of Peace, for example. And what does gun violence do for us? I mean, it creates chaos, it creates fear. And part of what I feel like Deanna and I are doing is hopefully, this is a hope, is it that kind of core story of Exodus, leaving a land that is a land of fear in a land of violence for something better. And this is, in some ways, this is wilderness time now, because we're caught in this weird in-between time where the narrative has been built for us. And now we're trying to overcome that narrative with a new narrative to get us to a better place. I mean, one of the things that I found out that was fascinating that I'd add to what Deanna said was that the NRA has been really, really smart in how they've done things. Now, I don't agree with them, right? Let's be clear, but they've been super strategic. In fact, I think it was 1995 somewhere, they got, and I think it was kind of, I think it was called the Dickey Bill, that they had a rider put on a bill where they actually outlawed not gun research, but funding for gun research, which is brilliant because nobody wants to add extra funds to bills. So if you just take out the funding, what happens to research? So then it just becomes your word against my word. Guns are safe. No, they're not. It's all about, you know, it's the gun or it's the owner. Well, hold on. Let's look at research. There was no research for a long time.
Yeah.
And finally, I think part of what I see a shift in is that over the last couple of years, they have figured out ways to give more funding to research. And so research is actually being done. So we have numbers similar to the numbers that you talked about at the beginning of this, Jeff, that actually you can look at as hard facts and say, the crap that they're spinning this with is ridiculous. And we need better arguments. We need more numbers. Because now when somebody says, you know, I need a gun in my house to keep me safe, there's new research that says, do you know that violence is, I think it's 75% or some really high number, 75% more likely to happen in a home that has a gun than a home that doesn't have a gun. Mm-hmm. And you can actually hold that up and say, what do you make of this? Here's what the research shows. Mm-hmm. So I think we're coming out of some narratives starting to pull back the vision. And I think as also as spiritual directors, this is a theological thing also, is we're trying to open the eyes of people whose eyes have been intentionally blinded. And I think we hear that in the Gospels constantly, of your sight being made well and blind people receiving their sight. And I think for me, that's a huge theological basis for the work we're doing. We're trying to elevate what is real rather than what is spin. And Deanna's probably heard this much more than I have, but in the hearings that we held here in Saratoga, we heard so much of the same garbage over and over and over and over again. They're really practiced. And the NRA has really trained folks in what to say and how to say it. And so I heard slippery slope. This is a slippery slope to you taking my guns. And I'm like, where's the slope? We're just trying to be safe. We're trying to keep our people safe. And we had a gentleman in the hearing. He was sitting right next to a police officer. And publicly, he said, I keep loaded guns all over my house. And the policeman looked down at him like, what in the world did you just say publicly? I mean, so we've been taught certain narratives. And again, I think part of the theology is pulling back the layers of our vision so that we can see the reality and what lies underneath a lot of what Dan already said, so that we can actually deal with it. And I think the public sentiment is starting to change also, where people who are really concerned with gun violence and into gun violence prevention are starting to meet some of gun owners who are willing to say, you know what? Yeah, we should keep guns safe. I mean, they're only willing to go so far, but how do we meet them where they are? And I think that's another thing that we can draw from our faith tradition of how do we really listen to people and work together for this kind of common problem, this common issue.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, I was perusing Jim Atwood's books over the last couple of days. And in 1990, the General Assembly of the PCUSA issued a statement saying the religious community must take seriously the risk of idolatry that could result from an unwarranted fascination with guns that overlooks or ignores the social consequences of their misuse. And it seems that that's exactly the hole that we've gotten ourselves in, where we idolize not only guns, but the use of violence. And I guess I don't know how far to take this, but it seems like this is so much a part of our history as well. I mean, the colonial period from the founding of our country was based on violence, violence against the native population and the genocide. And it has continued, century after century. And I think in some way that this is an illness. This is an epidemic. So how do we push back against that? How do we educate people? You know, and there's this concept that I sense that the gun culture. Now, full confession here. I'm a gun owner. I grew up using guns as a hunter. Went hunting with my dad, and it's been a long time since I've gone hunting, but I've gone shooting with my son and enjoy that. But there's a sense that I get that there is they conflate religion and violence such that for them Jesus is kind of Rambo Jesus. I've even seen images of Jesus with the, bullet belts across his chest, you know, carrying a AR-15 or something like that. It's just, it's so disgusting. So that's kind of the context that you have both set us up very well with. Tell us a little bit more about how you've done the work that is helping to push back on this. Eric, you've done some work in interfaith work and work in the community that, excuse me, I think has just been wonderful work. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I'm clear on is that this is not one group saying it's a problem. There are people across the spectrum that say gun violence is an epidemic. This is dangerous. This is a problem. I'm freaked out for my kids. What kind of world are my kids going to grow up in? Are they safe going to school? And what trauma is being done just in the sense of safe or shooter drills in elementary school? This is not a Jewish problem. It's not a Christian problem. It's not an Islamic problem. It's an us problem. And so when I started building this coalition, I found people like, sign me on. And, you know, rabbis and imams and Catholics and Protestants and everyone across the spectrum could say and could see that this was a problem. Now, they may not know what to do. And I think that's one of the big issues for the gun violence prevention community is what do we tackle first? And where, how do we organize? So we have a group, an association now that's gathered together. My group, representatives from Moms Demand Action, from SAFE. I don't know if you're aware of SAFE, but it's Scrubs Against the Firearm Epidemic out of Stanford. They've been fantastic. And Brady Campaign and some others. And we meet on a regular basis to strategize and to work and to engage elected officials. And there are a variety of religious backgrounds in that group. And it doesn't matter. I mean, there's no differentiation between us because we all know that this is a problem and we're up against an organized force, a well-funded, well-organized force that is ready to threaten legal action at any moment for anybody against anything to keep with the slippery slope argument that if it happens in Saratoga, it could happen anywhere. And then that could start the ball rolling to who knows what. And recently, you know, we've been working with California officials to try and get state secure storage passed in a more clear and effective way.
So tell us a bit more about the safe storage ordinances that some of your communities have been able to pass.
Yeah, so we are working hard in the Bay Area here, and we actually have a really good number. I think it's 75% now of the population in the Bay Area is covered by safe storage ordinances, which frankly for me should be low-hanging fruit. I mean, the NRA tells their members to keep their firearms safe. Why can't we get this passed in legislation? And so the idea is that when a firearm is not in your control, it should be safely stored. That's what safe storage is all about. And this keeps children from having accidents and finding their dad's gun and it going off and really harmful things, even death happening. Accidents happening. it keeps people from the middle of the night shooting their spouse. Mm-hmm. We've had that issue arise in the Bay Area, where somebody has a loaded gun next to their bed and they're disoriented in the middle of the night and their spouse is just kind of wandering around and comes in and they're scared and they got shot. I mean, those things should not happen. They should not happen. Safe storage helps prevent those accidents and other issues.
So what number of communities there in the Santa Clara County, for instance, are covered by safe storage? And is it safe storage in the sense of locked up or trigger locks? Or what do you mean by safe storage?
Yes to both or either of those, depending on the ordinance in the particular community. So, for example, Saratoga was, if it's not in your direct possession, it must be locked by a trigger lock or in a gun safe. Fantastic. There's a lot of parsing out and legal battles over how much freedom to give people in this. So if it's not in your direct possession, it must be locked. Or if you leave the house, it must be locked. There's some parsing out of all those things depending on the community. But I think Santa Clara County actually has a really good one that people can work off of. And we work with a legal group as well that has been wonderful in helping us craft some of these laws. They're amazing. So I think that's safe storage. But there's also prohibited persons, which is a huge deal, that when somebody has committed a crime with a firearm and they go to jail, they are then prohibited after they get out from owning a firearm. Great in theory, right? Because 55% of those people will use a firearm in another crime. 55%. It's huge. It's a big number. And who is going to go to the door to collect that firearm from them when they get out of jail? So I've had conversation with local and state officials who say, oh, no, the state gives the local folks money to deal with that. And the local police are like, Eric, would you want to be the one to go up to a convicted felon and ask him or demand he give you his gun? That's just not something that people want to do. And it's not high on their priority list. And from a human standpoint, I get it. But then who's going to do that? How are we going to collect those firearms to keep the rest of us safe? It's an issue that needs to be worked out.
Yeah. And even if they don't have a firearm, how do you keep them from getting another firearm?
Yes.
Not having a background check, gun shows or something.
Yes. Like that. And Jeff, one of the things about California that's, I think, maybe unique is that in California, we have some of the nation's best firearm safety regulations. And yet, right across the border in Nevada, they have some of the weakest. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm seeking a gun, I know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. And so it really has to be, I mean, we've talked in California about getting really good firearm safety legislation and hoping that that's going to be a movement that'll spark something through the rest of the country. Well, that doesn't always work.
Yeah.
Well,
thank you. And I guess I should also say, I used to be a member of the NRA. When I was a kid, I took the NRA safety course and it was great.
Yes.
I learned so much and gave me confidence, you know, how to stay safe around guns. And and so, I've always wondered, why would it be such a big deal to require people to have a safety course? I mean, we require them to pass a driving test when they're driving a car. So it seems like it would be a very small task in order to keep themselves and others safe. But I know that that's a big hurdle.
Well, Jeff, let's also be clear that the NRA has changed over time.
Yeah.
Let's be really clear, because to my mind, from what I've heard, the NRA started off as that, as kind of a safety group and teaching safety. Those are really good, admirable qualities. Mm-hmm. And as it has developed, it's been, in my mind, taken over by the military kind of industrial complex, who's trying to make more money on firearms.
Yeah.
And so when you have those folks in charge, it's going to become a different organization.
Yeah, and I specifically remember when I was a kid, driving with my dad, and we were having a conversation, and the NRA had recently come out against the outlawing of cop killer bullets that could penetrate vests for police officers. And my dad, lifelong Republican, said, "That is crazy. Why would they not want to protect people who are in need of protecting?" So I think from that point on, we stopped being NRA members.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, I'll ask Deanna to tell us about her work with the Gun Violence Prevention Project of Presbyterian Peace Fellowship. Stay with us.
And we'll say, "I'm gonna sing out, I'm gonna march on." And everybody said,
"I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on.
If you are new to our podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guest.
Deanna, tell us a bit more about your good work.
Yeah, I had so much to say. You know, you're going to have to put have a bell that you just ding. But so the takeover happened in 1977, whenever there was a split in the NRA and the leadership was taken over. And that's when the real extremism started. And then when they started going into, you know, actively becoming a lobbyist organization. But even, you know, it's all about gun sales. Let's just, there's no other reason, right? Why don't you have safe storage? Because guess what? If your gun gets stolen, you have to go buy a new one, right? If it's not stolen, you know, then you'll never be a returning customer is one theory you could take, right? So having those NRA stickers on vehicles was a sign that said, "Oh, there's a gun in here." So that's when they were actually getting guns stolen. And again, you would be likely to pass a background check. So you're the customer that they want to make sure gets stolen. So just always answer that question with, "Oh, it's going to get gun sales," right? And that if you have more gun violence, you get more gun sales. So, but my next question is, Jeff, since you've done this confession here before everybody, how is your gun stored?
I was waiting for that. And I don't have a gun lock. I've got it stored away safely, but it's not locked and it's not in a storage unit. So that's one of my to-do items.
Yeah. And I tell you, and again, because most folks that were started out as hunters, safe storage wasn't really an issue. You know, you talk about responsible gun ownership and you know to not store it loaded, you know, but I'll tell you how my dad stored his guns. ammunition was on the top shelf and the guns were all just lined up in the closet. And so I said to him one day, do you know if any of your grandchildren are suicidal? And he could not answer that. And I said, your guns are accessible to anybody who comes into your home, be it friend, family, or criminal, you know, or somebody, I hate to use that word because that's also a loaded word too. So, you know, but somebody who wants to steal, right? And that you are going to be contributing to that by not having it locked, you know, by the unintentional shootings, but even the suicides. The person who got me involved, actually a mom's demand action, that was her story, was a friend came in, knew there was a gun in the home, distracted, stole it, committed suicide with it. So, yeah. When you know it's got to be locked. That's just all. And so that's one of the things that we do, that we encourage, that this is what congregations can do, right? We can normalize that, because as Eric has alluded to, like, we can pass all the laws we want, but it's the enforcement where it becomes problematic. And so this is where we believe, you know, changing this culture, having, you know, churches, getting their congregations to be able to help normalize the ask. And I think that we even have a little bit more oomph behind us. And when we consider what's just happened with the pandemic, that we knew we wouldn't go visit grandma and grandpa if it wasn't safe, right? So we stayed back because of that. And I think we can do the same now, that we can be able to ask, is there a gun in the home and how is it stored? And if it is not safe, you know, we don't go there. And so that's one way that we can begin to help with that enforcement, to be able to normalize this culture to where it's not, you know, you ask this just like if there's a cat and there's allergies, or what type of special dietary restrictions do you have? Is there a gun in the home and how is it stored? And we're not going to come here if those guns aren't stored properly. I'm not going to bring my children, again, no matter what their age, because it can be a 24-year-old grandchild that might be suicidal, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you just don't know. And so it's important to normalize that. So that's what, when, so I'll slow down now and tell you kind of what happens generally for the Peace Fellowship as far as how we engage with congregations. So oftentimes folks go to the website and they download our congregational toolkit that we have for free. And in the toolkit, here's a printed copy of it. It looks like this. It's full of all kinds of resources that they can use for studies. Jim Atwood's books are in here. There's movies that are in here. And one I'll lift up, which is actually on the Peacemaking website. Last year, they did Standing Our Holy Ground. And one of the series of webinars, and one of the webinars is on the movie Behind the Bullet. And in this show, they look at the impact of being a shooter. They follow four individuals. And I think this is a great conversation that churches need to be having as well. You know, we often talk about kind of the injury that's happening at the end of the gun, but we're the right people to be talking about this moral injury that's happening, right? Like, what happens when so the gun industry is tell you that you need a gun to protect yourself. So what actually happens if you use that gun? Do we really address what's going to happen? Are we prepared to take a life? You know, that's because my father as a hunter says, you know, I've taken life and I know that I have no business having the gun as any form of protection because I'm going to hesitate. And therefore, it's going to be more a danger to me than it is in any way, you know, being able to take life. So I think we have this myth about what it means to take life. So that's kind of the first step, is people can download our toolkit, get into all the resources that are available there. If you're new, if your congregation, you know, is new to kind of gun violence prevention, we invite folks to really ground themselves in prayer, that being, bringing awareness to what is happening in your area, to the people that are being impacted by gun violence. And a great way to do that is to start to incorporate who are these folks that are in your regular weekly worship.
So one of the things that First Press Palo Alto did was we hung up a sign as a gun-free zone. Now, are those still available? Are those part of your kit?
Mm-hmm. There's a copy in the kit that you can get. I think you can also get them on the Peacemaking website. I will tell you, though, anybody listening who's from the state of Texas, this is one of the things that the gun lobby did is we can't put up just any old sign. We have to put up these, they can't be printed on a regular printer or photocopy. So there's a cost involved. You have to go purchase them. They have to be in English and Spanish, which I find just to be comical because it is the only time when the state is ever interested in acknowledging that there might be people with another language, you know? And so they suddenly go woke. This is when it comes to gun rights, right? This is where you'll start to see wokeness happening. So anyways, it has to be in English and Spanish, and you have to have a different one for handguns, whether they're concealed, for long guns. So anyway, so anybody to put up signage in Texas requires six signs at every single.
So there's not a freedom of speech in Texas about this issue?
No, not
require you to hang up a specific sign.
Specific sign.
And does that sign is of the state's wording or is it?
It's very cumbersome. You just look at a bunch of letters. Nobody knows what it says. You know, I mean, like you really have to have some form of education. And again, it's all intentional. Right. So that you get guns everywhere, or if you want to put up a sign, you can, but here's the key. It just won't be legally enforceable. Right. So you can put something up, but it's all about whether you want to be legally enforceable. So there's a congregation here, in Denton, Texas, and they said, you know, we weren't as much interested in the legally enforceable part as much as we were getting, just communicating who we were. But I will tell you, there's benefits to putting that sign up and being legally enforceable because it does help if you ever start to become a target from folks, right? Like if you do have, as we become more active and engaged and vocal, somebody might take issue, you know, like churches could become a place of contention. And so it depends on, again, like what happened in Texas as well was churches got removed from being protected sites for guns. And they got clarified as private property. And so you had to say whether or not you're going to have guns up. And if you don't say, Katie, bar the door, right? Like they can show up. So you could easily end up in a situation that you know, that wouldn't want to have happen. But I also think that we have, because we do have such good theological grounding that, this should fall under our First Amendment rights. You know, again, when we can start incorporating these pieces into our worship and be very clear about our biblical mandates to turn swords into plowshares, then that's a level of protection that we could have as if anything were to ever come, you know, if anybody ever wanted to make an issue. It doesn't happen often, but it could be something in places, you know, like I said, like Texas. I think Texas is a place where we're being a test ground for kind of pushing the bounds for what can be moving us into a more authoritarian type of you know, country in our laws. So it's an interesting, you know, time that we're in, and that's one of the things that just, you know, again, through the efforts of the NRA being able to get this Bruin Supreme Court decision, and we haven't really seen the impact of what that's going to do to our gun laws. So that's what can we say in absence, legislation is important, but in the absence of legislation, we don't have to give up, right? That there are still things that we can do. And that's part of it. Like you said, normalize the ask, have our own properties be gun-free zones to begin to show people, you know, to live into this vision, this alternative vision of what does it look like to reject violence and how do we keep ourselves safe and to start turning, you know, swords into plowshares, guns into garden tools. So we're inviting congregations to get chop saws and to begin dismantling unwanted guns in their communities. Well, that's what we've just found, that there are all these homes because we have more guns than we have people. We are this saturated market, that there are so many homes that have unwanted guns and they don't know what to do with them. And they don't want to return them to the market because they want the assurance that their gun's not going to be used for further harm, right? Like grandfather's gun. We want to make sure that it's not going to be used for further harm. And so churches can become safe surrender sites where they're able to dismantle these guns to where they're no longer working guns. And then they can be turned into things like garden tools. So what used to be an instrument of death.
Is that part of the toolkit or is that something separate from the toolkit?
So we do have in the toolkit, the kind of an outline for what a Guns to Gardens ministry could look like. And then we invite folks to come into our action circles in which we join with other people across the country, other congregations that we learn with and from each other. You know, this is a grassroots movement. So we're still trying to figure out how this is going to work best in different locations. It can work differently. And there are different laws in different locations that people have to take into consideration. So that's a come. It's not something that's necessarily like, here you go, here's a blueprint, go out and do this. We really like to engage in conversation around this and help people so that this becomes an ongoing ministry, not just these one-time events in which they do what we call these safe surrender events, in which you invite the community to bring the unwanted guns and that you'll dismantle them. But I have a pastor friend who actually has the guns that belong to a man who shot and killed his son. He felt like his son was angry and he just wanted to, you know, shoot a warning, but he ended up missing and shot and killed the son. So this gun was returned to the family. What do they do with them? Right. And so we believe churches can be these places for healings, for all these unintentional shootings that are out there, for the suicide guns that get returned to the family. You know, even the first gun that I dismantled was a friend of mine who was a Navy doctor, and this was the service weapon that he had. So there was a lot of emotion around this gun, and he just needed a place to be able to process that emotion. So by adding ceremony and ritual and prayer, we provide a place for people to really process, you know, all the varied emotions that come with guns, and particularly our culture, you know, the good motions as well as the harmful ones. So I'm imagining for you, Jeff, yeah, there's a lot of positive emotions around your gun, being that it was your father's gun and that this was something that you did with your son hunting. You know, I know in my family that that's a major bonding moment for the men in my family, was going out and hunting together and spending that time together. So we believe churches are the place to help people, you know, not only the practical aspect of dismantling their guns, but also this pastoral process that comes along. And we can be prophetic in that we can, you know, again, be about creating this world that is free of violence, we can inspire others to do the same. You know, we can inspire our lawmakers to take action, that when we see that citizens are voluntarily surrendering their weapons. And I think that's one of the most impressive things that's happened after Uvalde, is the number of AR-15s that came in, you know, via the Guns to Gardens events that were happening across the country. And also just gun buybacks, like the city of Houston has been holding gun buybacks ever since Uvalde. And they have brought in thousands of weapons. You know, their first one they had to shut down because there was such a long line. They brought in, you know, the one most recently, which was their third, they still brought in 800 guns. And this is in Texas, folks, right? Like people where we're supposed to be loving our guns and never giving them up. So, you know, there's a need. There is a need out there to be able to have a safe way to destroy these unwanted guns. And we just feel churches are the right place to help facilitate that.
Mm-hmm. Eric, can you tell us a bit more about the ordinance in San Jose that has become somewhat controversial about requiring insurance of gun owners?
Yeah, it has certainly become a lightning rod for many, but we were very excited and are hoping that it will continue. Let me say this, because a new mayor was elected last fall, so we're conscious that that may change things. But it was a new way of looking at things, similar to how, you know, thinking about a car as a dangerous weapon in some ways. As you have to have insurance and you have to have a license. And the money that they would garner from that would go into a fund to continue research, continue taking care of people, continue the effort. To me, it made a lot of sense because one of the arguments is, you know, we don't need insurance. Why would we need insurance? We're just protecting ourselves, the gun owners would say. Well, if your gun is used to harm someone or to harm property or to, I mean, if somebody ran you down with a car, you would expect insurance to kick in and provide for your healing. How do we hold gun owners to accountability for owning a weapon? Now, if you want to own it, that's your choice. Okay, I actually can say, I don't think it's great, but I will say that's your choice. And how are you going to be responsible? Because one of the problems we get into is too much individualism in this argument, is that it's just on me and I'm just responsible for myself. It's in some ways, it's like the old West. I'm just going to take care of my own. Well, you're part of a society. You're part of a community. And that gun can do damage in that community. It can hurt other people. If it's stolen from you and it gets used. So the San Jose initiative was to require people, gun owners, to own insurance, which I think is fantastic. And we'll see how that plays out over time. However, one of the research that led to that was this astronomical amount of money that gun violence causes the larger community every year in San Jose. Mm-hmm. And I wish I had that number off the top of my head, but I'd encourage people to Google it or research it, because the number was astronomical. What the cost of gun violence to a community. And if we just took a fraction of that money and invested it in healthcare, in schools and education and anything, we would be a better society.
So that sounds really interesting. And I've been interested in this take on this innovation. Is it being enacted at all?
I think it's moving towards being enacted. It's in process. I can't speak clearly about that, where it is right now.
Okay. And I think if I'm understanding properly, the hope is that this would become kind of a standard thing, just like you have insurance for your home, or you have insurance for your car.
Yep.
This is just an additional rider that might go on to your home insurance policy, something like that.
Something like that. And again, I don't know if it's California's innovation or arrogance, I'm not sure which, of saying that if we could get this passed and done, of course others would pick it up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because if we can prove that it works, if it can take down and deal with some of these other costs, I mean, we got to do something, Jeff. I mean, that's one of the things that drives me nuts, is that the NRA has kind of cornered the market on not doing anything, because it's everything is an infringement to Second Amendment rights. Everything. And there's so much that really isn't. It's really common sense that I think it's, Deanna, you may know the number better than I, but I think it's 85% of Americans think we ought to do background checks, for example. I mean, it's this astronomically high number of Americans who say we have a problem and here's some things that we would support. And still legislators get cold feet and their pocketbooks are threatened to suffer if they enact legislation. I mean, the NRA still has that power. And so we have to be aware of that, and we have to organize that. One of the things the NRA has done very effectively is stick to one message and organize, organize, organize. So from Texas to California to Virginia, you're going to hear the same response from NRA members when legislation is proposed. Slippery slope, Second Amendment rights, you can't infringe on my rights. I mean, something in that ilk, you will hear from coast to coast. Whereas progressive folks or gun violence prevention folks have 1,000 messages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we have all kinds of great reasoning. And yet it can become very fragmented. That's why our association here is trying to bring together the different groups who are working on this to say, let's pool our resources. Let's get Moms Demand Action and Brady Campaign and SAFE and all these big groups together somehow and focus on the same things, because then we can really provide some positive push to legislators in getting things done.
Let's take another break. And when we come back, I'll ask our guests about the connection between gun violence and Christian nationalism. Stay with us.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
If you are new to our podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guest.
This sounds great. And I know that a lot of the work that both of you are doing is interfaith and includes folks from other traditions. I guess what I'm wondering is, what is the connection that you see between this epidemic, epidemic of gun violence, this idolatry that we have, and the rise of Christian nationalism? Is there a link? Why is it that we see this so focused around Christian God and country and a kind of Rambo Jesus? What's going on?
There's a great book, Jesus and John Wayne. Are you familiar with that book? In which she, you know, kind of lays out again the intentional effort that was, you know, to lean into that form of theology, right? That it was seen that this could be used as a real leverage with folks. So I tend to, I have a lot of empathy for the everyday person in the pew, and that their leadership is really misleading and misguiding them. And again, they're exploiting kind of this long racial divisions that we've had in this country. And as you know, a lot of this stuff began to rise with the civil rights movement. And when people start to go for equality, it began, you know, to have this pushback to be able to mobilize again white power by turning whites into victims, that people are after you, and to do the same with Christians, you know, that people are after you, that you're the real victims here. And so this mentality, you know, this is all bred by the folks that are going to be able to profit either through power or through money or both. And so there is no doubt that Christians are, and in particular white male Christians, because that's who's predominantly gun owners, you know, are who have been kind of the focal point of the gun industry to be able to mobilize. You know, again, the way, as Eric said, you know, the NRA was very crafty in what they knew to do. And in fact, there's a book called How Change Happens by Leslie Crutchfield, in which she looks at movements, successful movements. And the NRA is who she looks at, because that was a successful movement. But one of the main components that the NRA did that the gun violence prevention movement was not doing was, again, that grassroots organizing and mobilizing. And so they're a little ahead of us in that regard, that they've been feeding messages to, again, the everyday people in the pew. And so, like Eric said, it's now our time to be able to start organizing and recreating messages by putting new visions. And we just had here in Texas our gun prevention advocacy day, and the statistics that register for me was that 70%, over 70% of gun owners want background checks in the state of Texas, yeah. Right? So this is favorable legislation, but it's because of the power, you know, that still is being held in Christian circles, you know, that started way back in the 70s, right? Like, this is long time nurturing and building that, that is more than just financial, but it's still kind of that voting power. But I think it's starting to slip. You know, I want to be ever so hopeful, but it's still, you know, it's like what we see, what's happening right now in the House. You know, they're it's kind of only a 30% group of folks that are really, you know, having, this extremism, but they're controlling the majority of that party, which is therefore, you know, still how things are going, even though there's a 70% majority. So anyway, so we all showed up. There were over 30 organizations that came together to Texas. And that is the messaging, right? Is the majority of people want gun safety laws. And we had you know, the Uvalde families were there. We had a former U.S. Army captain that spoke, and he's part of Giffords for Gun Owners. And so, you know, the majority is coming forward. We just need, you know, now for our lawmakers to begin to become brave enough. And it's happened in the Democrat Party, because we have to remember there was a time when even Democrats, you know, were having AR that rating from the NRA, right? They needed that A rating. So you're seeing that shift now with Democrats, and it's starting to shift a little bit into Republicans, and that, you know, we did have some gun safety federal legislation passed for the first time in like 3 decades, 30 years. So it's working. We just have to remember that. It's hard, but we've got to play the long game, because that's what we're seeing right now is the fruits of 40 years of organizing on the part of the NRA and others that are doing Christian nationalism, right? Like, this didn't just happen overnight. And that's what kind of, they said, you know, Donald Trump was not a shift. He was the fulfillment of all those years of organizing that they did. And so we just got to, you know, keep going, stay with it, and realize we are making progress, even though it may not always feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I'd also add that let's be clear that Christian nationalism is a huge problem and a very scary mentality that's been around forever, ever since Constantine made Christianity the state religion. And so this is not something new. I'll speak just as a representative of the Christian church. Christian church has lost its way quite often. Instead of being bearers of peace, we've caved into the larger culture around us. And I think guns and the power structure, I think power is a real issue with Christians, particularly with Christian leadership. Jesus saved his harshest words for the religious establishment of his day, the Pharisees and Sadducees. And we have forgotten that. Any number of studies have talked about, and I think Donald Trump helped bring this up, is that particularly the evangelical church had co-opted its message into being in bed with power. And Christianity historically has to take accountability for some of that and say, we are supposed to be the change and the peaceful counter to the ways of this world, of wealth, of wealth and poverty, and be that voice of spirit that says, we are all equal, we are all supposed to be safe. I mean, I think Deanna did a great job of bringing out, I mean, their deep racist roots in the gun movement, let's say, in owning guns. I mean, when slaves were being freed, white folks were terrified that they were going to rise up and perpetuate the same violence that the white folks have been doing to the slaves for generations. I mean, horrible evil. And so this white fear started to foment. And so you get people starting to equip themselves with guns to protect themselves. That's a pairing that is incredibly dangerous. And I think it's, dare I use the word evil, that there is some of that in there that we as Christians have to take accountability for and then work to correct that. We are not supposed to be in bed with the powers that be. We are supposed to be the counter of wisdom and spirit and hope and justice and faith and peace in the face of those things. And if we don't get, if the church doesn't get on board with that, we continue to go down, in my mind, a very dark path and a very dangerous path. And I think we need to have more what I would call progressive voices that can really speak that truth, not in a way of beating ourselves up, but saying, listen, this is the reality. And what are we going to do about it? How are we going to be that voice of change and that voice of the living Christ in our midst, who calls people out of bondage and into freedom, calls them out of separateness and into unity, calls them out of fear and into hope? I think I might have just started preaching. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But all right. Amen. Right? Amen. Keep going.
Yeah. So I think Christian nationalism plays on all of those fears and the powers and principalities, and just corrupts the Christian message, what the Christian message that Jesus taught, and what it was always supposed to be, and maybe has never really been evolved into what it needs to be.
And I've said, I think we need to, the church needs to re-embrace Jesus's ministry of healing.
Yeah.
That a lot of what we're dealing with is trauma, generational trauma, you know, and again, this racism. And so trauma that's unhealed becomes culture. And so this is now our culture. And so, like I said, these people are exploiting our trauma. And so that's going to be part of the role for the church, I think, to be this place of healing, you know, not to be so much in our head as we've, not that theology doesn't have a purpose, but right. we need to reconnect with this healing ministry that was, that's why people showed up to Jesus, right? He was healing them.
Yes.
And so then they came, they didn't come because he had good theology. It's important.
Yep.
But he came because he was healing people. He offered them hope and a new, you know, this new water, new life. And so that's what is happening, you know, folks are exploiting our trauma responses.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think this has been a great conversation and very helpful. Are there any websites or organizations that you would recommend that our listeners connect to that you would like to plug before we close?
So, you know, presbypeacefellowship.org is where you can go to get our toolkit and all of our information. But I also want to lift up, you know, the Guns to Gardens is a... we do that in partnership. It was the brainchild of Mike Martin. And so there's rawtools.org is another website that you can go to learn more about, you know, this idea of swords to plowshares. And then I also want to, who I think is really doing the best grassroots. It can, again, vary, but I tell you to text to Moms Demand Action. You can text Ready to 64433. Because they really are, a lot of what's happening is at the state level and the local level. And so you need who's doing that work. And you got to find your state and your local folks, because as Leslie Crutchfield says in How Change Happened, she was like, change doesn't come from Washington to the people. Change goes to Washington. So I think, Eric, you're spot on. You know, if you can get it to happen in California, it can spread. It may not spread to everybody, but again, you just need to get to enough to where Washington will then say, we can do something.
Eric, is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, yeah, I guess I would encourage people to do research. I mean, really check out what's happening. Go to Moms Demand Action is one. Brady Campaign is another. Safe is another. But do your research. And I mean, my understanding of Moms Demand Action is that it was just, and not just, it was a mom who got ticked off enough to start organizing. I mean, people have to understand that to empower ourselves is important. Get educated. Don't just stick with my word or Deanna's word or the NRA's word. Do the darn research to figure out for yourself what's really going on, where the money's coming from, who benefits from these things. What the numbers you quoted to start our time together, I mean, it blows your mind that we aren't more organized when there's astronomical numbers saying that this is a life and death scenario. I mean, if this was car crashes, I mean, this is how safety belts got regulated, right? I mean, there are deaths that happen. And nobody wanted to put a safety belt on in the car. Gosh, that was weird and awkward. Just felt bad when I'm driving. Are you kidding? And now we just put it on every day because it was in response to a problem. The same is true with gun violence. Get yourself educated, do your research, get informed, and then connect with a larger group because your voice matters. And with politicians, your voice represents 100 voices. If you write a letter, if you make a phone call, that has power. And when you magnify that by connecting with a larger organization, that's when things start changing. So get involved.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for this. This has been a wonderful conversation, an important conversation. And thank you for the work that you're both doing and helping others to do. So blessings on your work, and thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for hosting us, Jeff. Yeah.
Pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Benders of the Ark podcast, where we explore the stories of those who dare to do the hard work of social change and bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice. Be sure to subscribe and check out more stories and interviews at bendersoftheark.com. Our music is a splendid creation of Joshua Campbell titled Sing Out, March On. So until next time, keep bending the arc of the Moore universe toward justice for creation and all of God's people.